Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, February 26, 2010, I am delighted to be joined by Charlene Lee, who is the founding partner of Altimeter Group and co-author of Groundswell. Welcome, Charlene.
Thank you.
I'm so thrilled that you could join us. You are, you know, obviously very esteemed in your field. And, you know, it's been interesting to kind of watch the developments in the last couple of weeks in the Forrester space with blogging and people talking about Altimeter envy. What do you make of all of that? I'll kind of start out with kind of the harder question, I guess, because it seems like that's sort of a I wouldn't imagine you'd start a business expecting that kind of phrase, but Sage Circle called it that, so I thought I'd ask you about that off the top.
Yeah, I guess you don't mince words here. You just, like, jump right to it. It's great.
Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. With you, I would love to hear what you think.
Again, I can't say what other people are thinking. I can say what our experience has been like, and we're just right at the six-month mark right now. Of having announced the first set of partners, Deb, Jeremiah, and Ray, who joined me back in August. And it's been 6 months, and it feels like dog years in many ways. We've since added three more staff people, three more partners. We just announced Michael Gartenberg is joining us, who's very much into personal devices, electronics, and mobile. So what we're very focused on is meeting this one particular client need out there for our clients, because we're a consulting firm, of they have all these wicked problems, these really tough, disruptive technologies. And I think it's some of the things, when you look at these disruptive technologies, it's not something where you can just parachute in or read about in a report. It's something where you really have to dig down, because it's so disruptive to the organization, to the company's core strategy, that they really want deep thinking around it. So, and not just in one area. So we're looking at topics like social CRM. And you can't look at that from just the marketing perspective and the customer relationship perspective. You also need to look at it from the enterprise applications that I'll be tying into that. You need to think about all the different ways of looking at new innovations, so things like identifications and OpenID, which is what one of Deb's specialties. And then I'm looking at it from a leadership perspective. How is this going to change the way your organization actually works, the overall customer relationship and how that changes? So if to tackle these wicked problems, you need experts looking at it from many different ways, working very closely together. And I think that's what our expertise is around. It's very specialized in that area, and we are covering some of the hottest technology changes, because those are the things that are impacting and disrupting businesses.
And to back up for those that may be listening and aren't aware of what I'm talking about in terms of the Forrester, I don't know what to call it. There was basically Forrester changed its policy around personal blogs of those that work for them, I believe specifically the analysts that work for them. And basically it was, you know, a lot of people had opinions about that because many of them came to the organization with, you know, blogs they developed themselves. And there was a lot of discussion around, you know, why should or why doesn't Forrester see, you know, somebody with kind of a name brand reputation out there who's saying these thoughts are my own as not additive to the organization, but rather disruptive in their own way. Whereas with your organization, I think, you know, what people have come to believe is, you know, Jeremiah, you say his first name, and, you know, most of us, you know, all of us in this area, of course, know who you're talking about. You know, he has the web strategy blog, he continues with that, and it's really, you know, you and everybody you've brought in, you talked about, and I'm blanking on his name, your person who's the expert in sort of gadgets and innovation.
Michael Gartenberg.
Michael Gartenberg. I mean, just, you know, people that are so, you know, established and you know, in their area.
We have a very different business model, though. We do not put out syndicated research. And so our our front-facing, market-facing area is our blogs, our personal blogs. Those are carved out for my business. It is something that we do want to get. We want to get the top thought leaders and thinkers and advisors in this space. And they're not going to come to us if we're going to make them give up the blogs. And frankly, why would we? Because they already have these unique audiences. We do have IP inside of Altimeter, but I strongly believe that IP is one of those things that is so fungible, and especially in a space like disruptive technologies, it's as good as yesterday. I mean, it changes so quickly that anything you publish even just a month ago, a few months ago, is kind of out of date. So it's much more around methodologies, around practices, around frameworks that we as a company develop. And so those things are tested in the outside environment. Now, I can speak to my personal experience at Forrester. I can't speak to what they're doing or what they're doing it. But I was the first blogger at Forrester. And my blog was an official Forrester blog. It was on Forrester.com. And it was absolutely fantastic. Now, I did not have an existing blog outside. And I think for people who have their existing blogs and now have to think, well, do I join a firm, any publishing company that requires that I not publish my professional thoughts on that anymore? You have to think twice about joining any firm, not just Forrester, that requires that. It's going to be tougher to attract people who already have that. I wouldn't say never, but you could also see that at some point that policy could change. Who knows? As the marketplace changes, it's moving so quickly. But I understand. I understand why they felt they needed to do it. Because they have a syndicated publishing model.
Interestingly, you talked about how you're tackling kind of the organizational piece of consulting with companies. And I wonder if that extends to issues like this and, you know, kind of what your advice, you know, would, you know, do you ever advise in this area to various companies that you work with?
Yes, I do. And I think it really depends on the business model. Again, I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all. If you are a media company or IP company where you really do want to keep the information, again, very focused, in a place, not distributed, you want to consolidate. Think about the New York Times. They allow the reporters to blog, but they ask if they're going to talk about New York Times related stuff, that they do it on a New York Times blog. They don't restrict them from having personal blogs, and I don't think that's what Forrester is doing, but they're saying if you're going to write about stuff related to the New York Times, do it on NewYorkTimes.com.
Right.
So so for a media company, a content company, it makes a lot of sense to do that, and that's exactly what I advise them to do. Now, a lot of social media policies that are written by companies, they draw a delineation between what's done for work and what's done for personal. And they ask that you not write about work stuff in your personal blogs. Or they ask to identify that you are an employee and then don't write about it. So every company is going to be different depending on the kind of relationship they have with their employees and also the kind of relationship they want their employees to develop with the outside world.
And we should definitely give a shout out to the wiki that you've developed, where you do have a number of, for example, social media web presence policies for people to take a look at for you know their own purposes and in terms of adopting one for their company. I think it's a great service.
Yeah, it's sorely out of date, as people keep pointing out to me. The new book I have coming out called Open Leadership actually has a whole section in it around how to write and create these policies. I call them sandbox covenants because you have to define how big of a sandbox you want people to play in when they engage in these social technologies, especially in a public way. So if it's not clear to people, then people are left in limbo. What do I do? Can I do it? What I not? And you're much better off having a policy, knowing how big that sandbox is, and then having agreements inside of that sandbox, the covenants, to basically promise each other these are our responsibilities, what we will do and what we won't do.
So before we go on to your books, it'll be plural. I want to touch on one thing quickly that you mentioned when you mentioned that you're you are a consulting group, because I think a lot of people think of Altimeter Group as kind of the new way of being a analyst firm, but it sounds like you don't think of yourself that way. You certainly don't seem to. And having had the luxury of you were so gracious to host a social media club event, our first one this year, at your own offices, you know, we saw it's a great environment, but it didn't feel like the typical analyst firm. So just curious, you know, in terms of, you know, obviously you don't want to box yourself in, but are you defining yourself differently, and kind of how are you've kind of alluded to it, but I wanted to kind of ask you that question.
Yeah, I want to be very specific about it. The traditional analyst firm publishes research and does a little bit of consulting. We do a lot of consulting. That is our business model. That is our revenue stream. And, you know, we'll develop some other products in the future, but it's going to be much more around the advisory, the deep advisory that we have with a small number of clients. Now, do we practice influence, which is the other part of being an analyst firm? And I would say absolutely. We have a tremendous amount of influence, and it's part of our business model, again, from the marketing perspective, and also to give us access to be able to continue to be at the forefront of thinking around these technologies and the business disruption they cause. So It's a different model. It's not consulting in the way that McKinsey has done consulting, or Deloitte has done consulting, because for the most part, those consultants don't have the visibility in the marketplace. So it's different for them, too. And so we are trying new ways and a new way of doing things. And we've been lucky that we've gotten some people who think that way, and also fortunate for me, are very entrepreneurial in the firm. It's a really different kind of skill set.
There seems to be lots of synergy.
Yeah, and so, you know, are we crafting something new and different? Yeah, a lot of people kind of scratch their heads and look at us, well, what are you? It's one of the things we're trying to figure out. We're 6 months old, really. And what the way some people look at us as a new age analyst firm, and so we work with the AR people primarily in that. Others, in the vast majority of revenues, are not coming from vendors, are coming from end users. Others are saying, you know, we really need help with these really tough problems. What's the next generation technology infrastructure going to look like? Who are the leaders going to look like in the next generation CIO? What are the skills they need? How are enterprise apps going to change because of mobile devices or social technologies being built into them? How are relationships with your customers changing? And these are serious problems being dealt with at the C-suite, and they really want people to be partners with them in solving that. Now, our positions in the marketplace help us, first of all, have the credibility to walk into the C-suite, and then second of all, give us a perspective that they can't get anywhere else.
Absolutely. I wonder how much, you know, as a, you know, now a businesswoman who's, you know, the founding partner of this new group providing important strategic counsel, you know, very close range to C-levels, you know, how, you know, kind of when the idea, or when you can say the idea, came about, and kind of who, how you envisioned it growing. I mean, were there any surprises, or are things going according to the plan?
I think the biggest surprise to me is how quickly we've grown. I mean, when I put the plans together, first of all, when I left Forrester, I had no ambitions. I never thought in a year and a half I'd be sitting here with a big office, brand new office, you know, 12 people on, you know, working inside the company in one capacity or another, and over 40 clients. Never would have thought that. I'm working as hard as I ever have, ever in my life, and loving every single minute of it. It's just fantastic. And the thing that keeps me going are the people at Altimeter. And also, interestingly, the fantastic client relationships we have. It is so satisfying to be able to sit down with people week after week, month after month, day after day, and know how they're thinking and to be valued by them. And I was talking to a client the other day, and it was like a mutual admiration society. between her and the partners that she's been working with. The partners love her. She loves the partners. All love working with each other, and that's great. It's a fantastic feeling to be able to do that.
Anything that, in terms of building the organization, that has either helped or given you new perspective to now, you know, really specifically and more deeply counseling companies on their organization and leadership?
Yeah, I mean, we're a small company. So for me to be sitting here relating my experience to the head of a CEO of a Fortune 10 company, it can't, I mean. But the thing that's different, though, is around the book that I wrote around open leadership. It is about managing and leading in a very different way, where everything you do, again, in a partnership, it is, you know, you have to bring everyone along. And it's much more true to the type of open leadership principles that I think more corporations need to be thinking about, where the traditional command and control structures just don't work anymore. And they kind of do, but I think that we're at a point in our business today where a new type of leadership is really needed, where people are getting information from multiple sources. It doesn't come through a strict pipeline of hierarchy. Where work is getting done not just internally but also externally with people. So the biggest barrier I found in talking to people about using, to say, for example, social technologies wasn't the technologies, but it was more than anything else. Half the time I would be spending was about their feeling of feeling out of control, them feeling that, well, how open do I really need to be? So I get that question over again. Well, I know I need to be more open and transparent and authentic. Well, how authentic? And can you tell me how much I have to do this? Because I really don't like it. And my feeling is, you know, there's no going back to this. Nobody is truly authentic, truly transparent ever, not even with the closest people in our lives. We all have our secrets. So where do you draw the line, even not only as a person, but also as an organization? So that's been a lot of the work that I do now personally. And it's interesting because my partners, from a management point of view, throw open leadership in my face every day. So it's interesting. They're like, wow, are we being transparent about this? Or we have an intractable problem. We were just talking about one in our team meeting. I mean, we're going round and round in circles. And, you know, it's a tough question. Because it comes back to, what are you trying to accomplish? What does your marketplace need you to be? How open do they need you to be?
Absolutely. So one question that I wanted to get to, you know, before we go to open leadership, is the success of Groundswell. I think it's, you know, it was hugely successful when it first came out, and I still, when people say which books should I buy to get kind of up to speed, I still tell them to go to that. And I get kind of bummed sometimes because there's the Groundswell blog and you're not a part of it anymore. Boo-hoo. But tell me about the genesis of that, and also you know, you're a co-author, and how you find someone that you can work with where you're, you know, kind of what did you add and what did he add and kind of how that worked.
Okay, so first of all, the Groundswell blog is still very much alive and kicking. So Josh is still writing it. He writes wonderful things in there. So by all means, please continue to read it and tell your readers to read it too. And so thank you, first of all, for recommending the book. The book came about because I had been looking at it and researching it and looking at the space for a couple of years, and I just thought that there was a bigger story to tell. And it was much more around the impact and looking at this from a holistic point of view, and it couldn't be done in a traditional Forrester report. So I had an idea, and Josh wanted to write a book. So we kind of looked at each other and said, hey, let's partner on this, because I'm not that organized. And my team members all kind of teased me about it, but I found my to-do list. I had lost my to-do list, made it, and then lost it. So that's sort of my typical way of working. And so I'm sitting here going, there's no way I could do my job at Forrester and figure out how to write a book. And Josh wanted to write a book. So that's what we did. I continued doing my job full-time at Forrester, working. You know, I had a few cycles here and there to spend on the book, editing it, working on it, doing the interviews, structuring it, But the person who wrote most of the book, except for two chapters, was Josh. And, you know, just a fantastic person to work with. If I could, I'd write another book with them. We still talk all the time. He was just pinging me last week about his next book and how it's going and stuff. So we're still very much in touch. And unlike most co-authors, we had a great time writing it. And the reason being, we had worked for 8 years with each other at Forrester before we wrote the book. He had edited me. I had edited him. I had managed him. He had managed me. We had made each other mad. We had all those things out of the way before we started writing the book. So we could just focus on writing the book.
So Groundswell's sort of subtitle is Winning in a World Transformed by Social Technologies. And your new book is Open Leadership, How Social Technology Can Transform How You Lead, to be published in May 2010. Tell me about the process in, you know, kind of comparing the two situations, the process, you know, in creating the new book.
Well, the new book is my book. I wrote it, and I had help. I had a co-writer, researcher, who helped me through the process, too, as well. But in the end, all those words, I had to write in the end all by myself and be organized about it this time. And it was really hard, honestly, doing that, having a client base, and basically I was starting Altimeter at the same time.
I know. I don't know how you did that.
It was really insane. The only way I did it was because of my great husband and the person I acknowledged and my acknowledgement. Couldn't have done it without him. I think, again, the reason I wrote this book was because of all the conversations I had with people. And I just felt like the reason I wrote Groundswell with Josh is like I had a book in me that needed to get out. And it was very much the same way this time. It came pouring out because there was just a story to tell again about this transformation and a need for leadership to change, for people to think very differently. And the reason being, we have something's happened over the past 2 years. That's very unique. Our society has changed because of these social technologies, because we now have a culture of sharing. We couldn't really share that well before. Now it's really easy. And that has transformed the way relationships work. And because of the free flow of information and because decision-making has changed, those two areas have become much more open, and that has caused stress inside of organizations. So when I go out and talk to organizations and speeches and my consulting practices, they're stressed out not because of the technologies, but because of the change it causes inside their organizations, how they work with each other. It changes the way you talk to customers. Oh, wait, we have to talk to customers now? We only messaged them before. We have to talk to them? What do we say? How do we say it? How do we not look stupid? So there's a lot of angst in that.
Yeah, and I mean, it absolutely ties to business and the bottom line these days. And I wonder, you know, it's interesting because I know, you know, having gone to Columbia Journalism School, you know, there's this constant discussion of, you know, is the school teaching, you know, as graduates of the school, we want to make sure that the school is doing everything it can to be, you know, ripe for the digital age and prep people the right way to tell stories in interesting and perhaps multimedia format, those types of, you know, all different kinds of formats, and to be more flexible than they've ever been in writing. And you yourself went to Harvard Business School, and I wonder how much when you write this book, if you could think about, you know, kind of the practicum you learned as part of the core at Harvard Business School, if this really looks at some of those things and turns it on its head, or, you know, do you have any contact with, you know, people that you have conversations with about how business has changed?
Yes, I do. And one of the audiences that I wrote the book for was in my mind, at least, and definitely in the writing, were business schools and HR people, and thinking about how you develop skills around leadership. Leadership is one of those things that a lot of people write books about and practice and think about it and try to improve on all the time. And it's more of an apprenticeship in some ways than an actual course that you can take. And so what I was thinking here is that leadership has the requirements for leadership are very different in the social world, where leadership is expressed in many different ways. So you could say that I'm I exercise a lot of leadership in the social technology space. But even before I was at Altimeter, I didn't run anything. I had a tremendous amount of influence. And mm-hmm. so leadership is being defined by a lot of different ways. And I believe that, again, leadership isn't necessarily based on the traditional thing of now you're a manager, you have to take on certain levels of leadership, sort of a leadership pipeline philosophy. Somebody who is a frontline worker can exert leadership, absolutely can exert leadership in an organization by running and writing an influential internal blog or being a resource around a particular area and be an expert or being having a close relationship with a customer and therefore a strategic customer who is extremely important then walks into the C-suite to explain how that customer thinks. So leadership is changing. The nature of it is really changing because mm-hmm. the hierarchies are being broken down. And what I found so fascinating is that there's been this clarion call for flat organizations because it's good for the human soul, for people to feel vested, be connected to the executive branch. Mm-hmm. And it goes all the way back to Peter Drucker doing research back in the 1940s around GM. Mm-hmm. But he talked about it. Tons and tons of people have talked about it in the lexicon of business thinking and research. But it hasn't been possible until just the past 3 years because there was no way to actually bridge the communication gulf between all the different levels. We now have that. We now have the ability for the chairman of the company to hear and see exactly what somebody at the front lines is seeing and doing with a customer because all of these conversations are now transparent. Couldn't do that before. The CEOs will call down to somebody, not because of a report that was written, but because they saw it on the Twitter feed. And that's really the fundamental sea change we have here. Now, so, the CEO is saying, well, how do I do this? I don't know. I don't have these skills.
Do you think that those skills can be built completely, or is it really a mindset that's very hard to accomplish without embracing all of the changes that have taken place over the last?
Yeah, really good question. I think in the book, I talk about two things. One is a mindset, which is much harder to change. You can change it, but it takes a lot of time. And then there are the skills and behaviors that are reflected in the actual activity. So you could have a mindset that is actually very pessimistic about what happens when people are open. In other words, if you think you're pessimistic if you think that if people are given the chance and the power to do something, will they do good things or will they do bad things with it? And people tend mm-hmm. to fall on one side or the other. So if you're pessimistic and the other part of the 2x2 is are you collaborative or are you individualistic when push comes to shove when trying to solve problems? So when there's an intractable, tough problem, do you turn to the people around you or do you double down and say, I can solve this? We all use different ways of solving problems, but we tend to go in one direction versus the other. And so if you're individualistic and pessimistic, it's going to be a lot harder for you to be open because you're not going to trust people to solve the problems, and you're not going to trust that if you gave to them the opportunity, they would do the right thing. Given that, if you recognize that about yourself and you realize that you as an organization and as a person need to be more open, you need to partner with people on the opposite side. So mm-hmm. somebody who is optimistic and collaborative, and so that you can take, so they can compensate for the areas where you're not strong. That said, you can still, I've talked to many individualistic and pessimistic people, leaders of organizations who have blogs. And the reason they have the blog is they understand why it's so important to do it. They struggle every week to write that blog. It's not in their nature to do it, but they do it because the objective is very clear about why it's important for them to do this, why it's important to have those relationships. Their customers and their employees need it, so they do it. Even though it goes against every grain in their soul to do that, they do it.
So the people that kind of are the most, that are kind of primed to be the most successful in the new economy, I'll call it for lack of a better term, I would imagine spans, you know, socioeconomic, age, gender, and other groupings. But I'm wondering if there's any insights you have into those that tend to be, you know, some sort of segment that tends to be more successful and maybe a segment that tends to have more need for help?
Yeah, well, definitely there's generational aspects to this, but it's not an absolute. So if you're older, you tend not to, especially if your experience has been that you're rising through the hierarchy, you tend to believe that you got there because of your individual achievements. And so while you still work on a team, people are looking to you as an individual, as a leader, to provide the answers. So as you go up in the hierarchy, you tend to become more and more individualistic in the way you get things done and where you turn to for those sources of insight when things come push or shove. And so it gets harder and harder the higher you go inside an organization, tendency to be able to let go because you have so much power and control. And what I interview quite a few leaders of organizations to understand why do they consider themselves open leaders. And two characteristics came up. One of the first one was it wasn't necessarily intrinsic and natural for them. I talked to John Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, and he said, you know, I am a very command and control kind of guy. I got to where I am because of command and control. But once I got here, I realized that I could not continue in this way because if I wanted Cisco to turn around and do the things I needed to do, I couldn't be at the middle of that. I had to let go of decision-making, and the only way I could let go of decision-making was to make sure that we had much more open and fluid information sharing, too, as well. So they have this very complex decision-making process, councils and boards at different levels and you know, rules and everything, and they're co-led. And you would think that any kind of committee that was co-led, that was cross-functional, would just bog down in details. But in 45 days, I mean, the things that they were doing, completing four multinational acquisitions that were billions of dollars, you know, debt loads, quarterly meetings, he personally met with 125 clients, again, in a month and a half. I was exhausted just hearing what he was saying. And then he says, I could accomplish so much more because I've let go of control. I can do so much more because I don't have to be in the middle of it. And the kicker was, he goes, and I'm working less than I was 2 years ago. And I'm like, I'm signing up for that. So I think that's the concern, again, is that if you let go of control, you won't be able to get things done. And the opposite of that, of the whole caveat of leadership, is that the only way to get things done is if you let go of control.
Be open. I wonder, you know, you touched on this by kind of bringing, you know, your own kind of exclamation point to the fray. But in terms of gender, you know, one of the things that is, you know, amazes me is in addition to the book and creating Altimeter, at the same time, you have, you know, you're a dedicated mother of two children and the wife of a venture capitalist who's pretty well known, and you've been able to maintain all of that. And I would say that you're a very successful leader in that, you know, people are headlining things with envying your organization already after 6 months. So, you know, for you, do you find anything in terms of, you know, being female versus, you know, John Chambers or any other of the guys that you interviewed, maybe some of the other women executives that you probably interviewed as well? Did you find any kind of interesting tidbits there for people to take a look at?
Yeah, you know, it always is an issue when it comes to finding women leaders, period, to talk about these kinds of things. I didn't have enough case studies to see any kind of trend, and I wasn't necessarily looking for one. I will say that being in so many different areas, I as a woman have to be much more open and transparent about the work-family balance. And what's interesting is that as a woman, I actually have more permission to talk about those issues than if I was a man. For that, I consider myself to be very fortunate, because I've taken my kids, for example, on business trips, and there was one business trip I remember in particular. I was a keynote speaker, but nobody wanted to come and talk to me because I was with my son, and it was kind of sad in some ways. I didn't know what to do, and it was our first trip, and it was a little bit awkward, and now I know exactly what to do. I just haul him everywhere and introduce him to everybody, and he's just part of the conversation. but you don't see very many men traveling with their kids. Quite a few do, but it's not something that's brought up. And when a woman shows up with a kid, it's seen as balance, and she has to do it, whereas the man comes and does it, well, he's being a great dad. So there's a bit of a double standard. I don't care. I just wish that it was, it could just be more natural that this becomes part of the conversation, that we do take that into account. One of the core values we see at Altimeter, and something I wrote in right from the very beginning, is the sense of this value of balance. And it's balance in our lives, but also balance in the way we approach the problems we're solving. Absolutes like "you must be on Twitter" make absolutely no sense. Because, well, how do you know you have to be on Twitter? Does it make any difference for your work? Is it the right thing for your customers? That kind of advice I hear coming from people just doesn't make any sense.
And it's very hard when it's not strategic.
It's not strategic. And in the same way, when it comes to work, family, and balance and everything, I've been very lucky. I've been able to make it work. But I have some colleagues who say, you know, I just don't work on weekends. And I have other colleagues who work all the time, all the time. And we respect that. We respect that we have different ways of approaching. We're all united in the same goals, but the ways we get to that goal is going to be different. So I have one, we were just talking about it this morning, I have one partner who is in many ways the polar opposites of me in terms of getting work done. And it causes tension, because the way that he wants to get it done is completely opposite from the way I want to get done, and our vision of how the company will operate as a result is completely different. And we have to work out those differences as a relationship, in a partnership, in any company. But I think it's the same case when you think about these changes that are happening. Those things get laid bare a lot more frequently because of the transparencies now that you have inside organizations. You could kind of hide from them, and you could kind of ignore them and avoid them in the past. It gets harder and harder to do that when more and more of this information is out there and the way that people communicate is out there.
Very interesting. I wonder if there are kind of universals you talked about, because I think this is a really interesting area, actually. I think that there's a lot of leaders, whether they're at the SVP, VP level or the CXO, level, where there are these messages that somehow get through. I don't know if it's the snake oil salesman out there or kind of where it comes from, but, you know, have to be on Twitter, have to be on Facebook. I remember going in to meet with a company, and, you know, they have their product is so expensive. It's a information management data system that is extremely complex. And, you know, it's extremely expensive, extremely useful, but they have maybe 13 target customers in the entire world. And their PR company came in and said, oh, well, we'll create a social media strategy for you. And when I reviewed the strategy, I was shocked to find that it was just a Facebook page. And with those 13 customers being very high C levels or board members, I'm going, how many board members are going to make a purchasing decision or be swayed or influenced by Facebook, if they're even on it or know what it is?
Right.
So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about a concern that I have, which is I think shared by many in the community that deal with social technologies, and that is the people that kind of that come during times of opportunity. A lot of people need help right now. And if they don't have a strategic background and haven't been doing this for a long time, can maybe provide the wrong counsel. And I feel like there's some areas where there's you know, wrong counsel given kind of consistently. One of them I share with you, which is have to be on Twitter. Well, not necessarily. And there's risk if you don't manage the account correctly as well. So you don't certainly, especially at very, very large companies, want to create a scenario where you're getting covered because of something you said or didn't say on Twitter. What are your thoughts on that, on kind of the quality control? I mean, there's certainly not certification around social media that everyone agrees on, or even, you know, I think of social media as sort of a subset of web strategy. But what are your thoughts on that?
I agree, and you hit the nail on the head that there is no certification process. Again, it's not even an apprenticeship. People are just hanging up shingles.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's sort of buyer beware that if you're going to go and get advice from somebody, it's awfully hard, and we're seeing it. We see the pain all the time from companies big and small. So, and there's no easy solution to this because it's sort of like the early days of the web. You got to have a web page. Well, that's sort of truism now. So you got to have a web page.
Mm-hmm.
But what you do with it is so different depending on what you are trying to accomplish. So my advice to people is if you don't know what you're getting out of Twitter and Facebook and blogs and all these social technologies, if you really don't know what you're getting out of it, just stop it.
Mm.
I mean, stop it. Take some time. Figure out why you're really doing this, what you're getting out of it. I'm not talking about ROI, but how are you moving the relationship forward with your employees and with your customers? Do you know how you're moving it, how you're changing the equation, how it's really impacting your business, how it's making a difference? If you can't even answer that, if the people who are promoting these things to you can't answer that, then get somebody else. Get somebody else. So for your example where they have, I think you said 13 different CEOs and companies, it may
mm-hmm.
make sense. It may actually make sense for them to have a Twitter account, but it's not to meet those, to reach those 13 companies. It may be actually reaching the customers of those 13 companies,
mm-hmm.
providing background and support in the particular area that that company is an expert in. It's providing,
mm-hmm.
again, information, thought leadership around these things with a combination of a Twitter, Facebook, blog, where they could be reaching thousands of people on behalf of their customers. So reaching the end customer, not the distributor in between.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Be thinking about that. And kind of that's an important strategic thing so that they can go to the customer and say, hey, we're having these conversations about the product, the end users of our products. We are clearly not selling it. We're doing it in support of your sales. Isn't that a great thing? And what can we do differently? That's moving the relationship forward with your customer that's closest to you. But it's
mm-hmm.
also writing larger and having conversations with customers you never had a chance to talk to before.
So that brings up a great point because a lot of this is about conversation. Online conversation usually means writing or text. It can mean videos and multimedia too, but you know, blogs, you know, or play an interesting role and sometimes a pivotal one. You know, certainly they are important for SEO and they can be important for organizations in that way, but they can also just be important in terms of the thought leadership process and getting across the point of view of various players within an organization. One of the things I think that kind of ties to that, and I'd love to get your thoughts on, is, you know, the PR industry being so, you know, actually trying to get more social. But in a lot of ways, by providing blog content or maybe the skeleton of a blog post, areas that are kind of really gray in terms of, I want to say ethics, but I think it's kind of accepted, unfortunately or fortunately, by a lot of people that, you know, a certain number of tweets are from a PR firm, unless you can really tell a consistent voice is coming through or you really see a commitment from someone. I mean, I used to say when I worked in television news, you know, I would be, you know, if I was producing a 5 o'clock and sitting through a 6 o'clock with my news director and say, she just said the name of a website, but I know she's never been online. I can tell. And I think people have a pretty good sense for that, but I feel like, you know, this all ties into where PR is as a business and it trying to kind of redefine itself. And I know that's a really broad topic area, but if you want to hone in on just kind of your thoughts on a particular piece of it, would love to hear what you have to say.
I think the way traditional PR has always been pitching from the perspective of the company. And it didn't matter how you got it. You were compensated and rewarded and patted on the back for getting in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, or the equivalent of that, getting written up by, let's say, Robert Scoble. Okay? And that's oftentimes what the client wants. And I think as any good PR person would say, you know, it's not about getting the article. It's not about getting the blog post. It's really about the relationship you can form with the larger audience in general. And that's the big difference now. The sources of influence are much broader. So for PR to redefine what that means and realize that the way you develop those relationships, which is the public relationship part of PR agencies, it's very different. You can't just pitch. You really have to have a relationship with people now. That takes a different skill set than I think many traditional PR people have had. And I was just talking to somebody today, and they were talking about how, you know, we want to go out there and talk to people, but we're afraid that we're going to go out there and just be spamming people. And I'm like, yeah, if you approach it the traditional way, you definitely would be. So they don't necessarily know how to do PR in a non-spammy way. But it also was very revealing that, you know, probably the stuff that you were doing today in the traditional channels is also being perceived as pretty spam. So targeting the right people with the right message, knowing what they want to hear about, and really having a good sense of what they want to hear about so you know not to spam them is the key thing. That kind of radar, that sort of sixth sense, doesn't come overnight. This is a key point.
Very true.
This is a key point. That in this space, what most companies fear more than anything else is failure. And I put a whole chapter in the book around the failure imperative. In fact, you have to be ready to fail. You have to expect to fail. And you have to do it very well, gracefully, and then recover from it and move on from it. Because these are relationships. Relationships are messy. Relationships are never perfect. Mm-hmm. And a key part of relationship is being able to say, I was wrong, I'm sorry, can you please continue on?
Mm-hmm.
So they don't teach how to fail in business school. They only teach you how to succeed. And how do you fail successfully has everything to do with how you succeed. So I talked about a little bit about open leadership having two characteristics. The first one is about letting go of control. The other one, I think, is knowing how to fail. And in particular, being very honest about it. All the open leaders had very strong philosophies about how they fail to a person.
I remember you, Web 2.0 Expo, I think it's been 2 or 3 years ago now, interviewing Max from Slide.com, who had the failure at PayPal. And you guys touched on that a little bit. And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, he was really rallying that failure was, you know, he'd had so many failures and he talked about his maxed out credit cards. And I wonder, you know, would we look at Slide and say that's a success still in its space? I think it's so interesting that, you know, at that moment it was probably the hottest thing on Facebook, and now things have changed a bit, and looking at iPhone applications might be the more popular way of doing things. And that's not to say that Slide isn't super successful. It's just that I don't know. It's kind of dropped off the radar, at least for me. But, you know, I think your input at conferences is something that people look forward to. And I look, you know, every once in a while at your calendar on the Altimeter site at the conferences that you or the gang are attending. And it seems like you have a more defined set of conferences that you're going to than, you know, I know Jeremiah used to be known as the road warrior. He was everywhere all the time. But like, for example, are you going to South by Southwest, or are you focusing more on international conferences?
Yeah,
kind of where's the focus there?
Yeah, all of us are going to South by Southwest, actually. So,
woohoo!
Yeah, it's just a great place to meet and connect with people. And we as a partnership are absolutely committed to meeting regularly with each other face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important. We all work virtually. We work very well. We're all sort of functioning. Our entire business is based in the cloud. Four of the partners are here in San Mateo, and the other three are all over the country. We anticipate we're going to keep adding people remotely. So it's important that we get together. As Deb Schultz was saying, I didn't join a company to sit on my desk and not see anybody. I work with other people. And to work with people effectively, you need to form those bonds. And those bonds, there's nothing like going to South by Southwest and party to form bonds. So going there to get work done as a company, but also to bond and also to meet with lots of very interesting and neat people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm speaking at South by, I'm speaking at Web2 Expo. So those are sort of more traditional places. But I'm also speaking in the fall at the World Business Forum, which is in Radio City Music Hall, and I'm speaking right before Al Gore. So
very exciting.
It's very cool. And for me, that's sort of how I'm transitioning myself, and also how Altimeter is very different. It's that you don't just talk about the tech space. We're really talking about business problems. It's really
mm-hmm.
about business problems that technology is, in many cases, causing and also can solve. The Wood Business Forum is fantastic because I will be talking about open leadership to the top leaders in business. And in the context, again, that this is no longer something odd, a bright, shiny object. This is something that's at your front door you have to deal with. These social technologies, it is so transformative, you have to deal with it.
Hmm. Now, so and I know that you spoke there in October of last year, I believe, right? At the World Business Forum?
No, I'm speaking this fall.
This fall, so will this be your first appearance?
At the World Business Forum, yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow, very, very exciting. So do you have conferences this year where they're first for you? Because it seems like the world stage has kind of opened up to you. I mean, it probably was always open, but, I mean, obviously you're the leader of your company now. So I see, it seems like on your schedule there are more things that are, you know, about what's happening in the world as opposed to the kind of traditional, like we talked about, the South by Southwest, the 2.0 Expo.
Yeah. Again, I'm doing the Community 2.0 Expo conference in May in Boston. But I'm doing a lot of other conferences. I'm doing one later this month in Brazil,
very exciting.
Focused on different things. And the week before, I'm in Oslo for Rethink, which is, again, South by or Web2, is very much in this space. So I think I'm still very much in both worlds, which is fantastic. But it's crossing over into the more traditional business world too. Sitting down, the types of people I speak to now, today versus a year or even a year and a half ago, are very different. Still very much sometimes the interactive person, but increasingly so the head of strategy, the CMO, and oftentimes the CEO of very, very large companies. So it's a different kind of conversation that I have now.
So going back to the original vision of your company and how it's, you know, it's really in the consultancy space. It's a different kind of company than a traditional analyst firm. Who do you see as your competition?
That's a great question. And what's interesting is a lot of people put us in the same boat as Dachas.
Okay.
What's interesting is we sometimes compete against them, sometimes we're partnering with them. And I'm speaking at their summit. I'm keynoting their summit right before South by. So are they competition? I guess so. Are they partners? Absolutely. Pete and I talk all the time, and he invited me to his summit. So what does that say about what competition means in the future?
Mm.
I don't know. I really don't know, because we don't sell a product that people buy Coke or Pepsi, and the reality is I like Coke, but I drink Pepsi a lot too. So and so what's competition in the same space?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I win some, they sell some, and we kind of sell together. I mean, we actually pitch some business together. So
mm-hmm.
I kind of go, it, you know, there's no direct competitor because we are only 6 months old. We're pretty small in the scheme of things. We sometimes come up against traditional analyst firms. Sometimes we come up against the traditional consulting firms. Other times, we just kind of show up because there's nothing else. It's so new, they don't know how to go about tackling these problems. So the way I look at it and what I focus on is not about competitors, because I don't know what I'm competing against necessarily. I'm just much more focused on solving the client problems that are just coming at us like a tsunami. There's just tons and tons of requests for us to solve these problems. Some of them we can do a really good job with. Others we kind of go, you know, it's not a good fit. But here are the other people who can do a great
mm-hmm.
job, or who can do a really good job with this. They have all this data. Go and talk to them. You know you're a client of theirs. They can really help you with this. We can't. Go talk to Gartner. They have the premier expert in this particular area. Go talk to them. Go and talk to your consulting firm, McKinsey, or your advertising agency or your PR firm, because they can provide that kind of support, that level of support that we can't. We're a 10-person firm. We can't do those kinds of heavy lifting, go out there and manage our Twitter account for us.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, you know, like obviously having a professional services-based organization, and I that's what I'd classify you as. I would assume that's how you classify yourself as well. You know, there's always the question of scale, you know, and how much you can scale. And also, I would imagine the funding piece. Was that something that you had to worry about going into this, or were you able to self-fund it without getting, I don't mean to get personal, but, you know, just I'm sure other entrepreneurs who might have ideas for creating companies in different spaces are going, how do I kind of go about it?
We bootstrap this organization. When you're a partner in the firm, you don't make money unless people sell. And being a partnership, it puts a lot of pressure on each of the partners to go and sell. I mean, and that's the great thing about this is that all of us have our relationships and all of us have been able to leverage it. To talk to people and oftentimes new clients who have come in. When I left Forrester, my first three clients were clients I did not have relationships with when I was at Forrester. So,
wow.
And the people who I thought I had great relationships with, you know, they kind of like Forrester better. I'm like, I totally understand that. So it was three new relationships that I didn't have before. I mean, I knew them, but it was not a consulting relationship I had with them. So it's kind of, it keeps surprising us. Sometimes this market, again, is so dynamic that the people who are looking for the help are not necessarily the ones who were there just even a few months ago.
Interesting. Well, I can't let you go without asking you. You know, revealed your love of reality television. What are you watching these days? Do you have time for TV?
Survivor. I'm totally watching Survivor. The 20th anniversary, you know, showing the heroes versus the villains. I'm loving it. So I haven't seen last night's episode, so don't tell me anything about it.
I won't. That's great.
I'm
so
do you
let your kids watch?
Oh, yeah. We watch Survivor together. It's one of our family activities. So it's too late on Thursday night, so we watch a Friday night together. That's what we do.
Aw. And then what about science fiction? That's another area that you love.
No, since I've been writing the book, my book reading has fallen off completely. I subscribe to audible.com, and
uh-huh.
I usually take the books with me and listen. I am so far behind. I think I have like 12 credits or something that I haven't used yet. So I turn in the galleys for my book this weekend. I actually read half of the galley for this new book by Dana Chip Heath called Switch, which is fantastic.
Oh, very cool.
It's really good, and I think very applicable for our space and the social technology space, which is how do you make change when change is hard? And it is a fantastic book that I had to put aside. I have to start reading my book again. It's fantastic. I read through half of it, couldn't put it down. So I think it's a great book because, in the end, social technologies, getting them to be adopted inside your organization is about change management. And it's really hard to do that. So I think this is a great book to think
very, about. Very great to have that recommendation. On that note, Charlene, we're going to have to let you go. Get on with your day. I'm sure you're very busy. And thank you so much for being on the program.
Hey, thank you.
It's been great. And we'll let you go. And thank the audience for tuning into the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay, and, of course, our featured guest, Charlene Lee. Be sure to tune in next week, Friday, March 5th, when my guest is Justin Kahn, creator of Justin TV, 1 week from today at 12 noon Pacific. Have a great weekend.